You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, November 16th, 2021. I'm Megan Newman from Drake University. Here is our first story. Lecture to focus on Chinese laborers who worked on Transcontinental Railroad by Tim Johnson. The Union Pacific Railroad Museum will host a virtual lecture Wednesday on the historical neglect of Chinese railroad workers in the 1800s. The lecture, titled Ghosts of Gold Mountain, Chinese Building the Transcontinental Railroad, will be delivered virtually at 6 p.m. Wednesday by Dr. Gordon Chang, a professor at Stanford University. Chang will speak to the historical neglect of the Chinese railroad workers and the vital role they played in constructing the Transcontinental Railroad, according to a press release from the museum. Chang has spent decades researching the workers' history and published a book on the topic, Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. This Stanford-based historian has done significant work in uncovering the often untold history of the Transcontinental Railroad's Chinese labor force, said Patricia Labonte, curator of the museum. Chinese laborers were hired by Central Pacific and are central to Dr. Chang's book. I expect his presentation to be historically accurate and honest. This presentation aligns with the museum's mission to recognize generations of people who have been impacted by the railroad. The lecture ties in with a temporary exhibit at the museum on organized labor on the railroad. Though they constituted 90% of the labor force on the western portion of the line and were credited with carrying the burden of its construction, Chinese workers faded into the shadows of history over time, the press release stated. This talk will speak to the historical neglect and share insights into their experience gained from a decade of research and the publication of his book. Chang is the Olive H. Palmer Professor in Humanities and Professor of History at Stanford University, where he also currently serves as the Senior Associate Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education. He was the former director for the Center of East Asian Studies and co-director of the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America Project. He is the author of Ghosts of Gold Mountain, Fateful Ties, A History of America's Preoccupation with China, and author or editor of six other books. Those interested in viewing the lecture can register at upprmuseum.org. Five Pottawatomie County Art and Culture Programs Receive Funds by Emily Sheeb. The Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs will award $1 million in grants to 118 arts and cultural groups in Iowa, five in Pottawatomie County, through the Iowa Arts and Culture Marketing Grant Program. This program was created with federal COVID-19 funds allocated by Governor Kim Reynolds, according to the Department of Cultural Affairs. The State Arts and Cultural Agency developed a related promotional campaign and toolkit based on input from statewide arts and culture leaders to encourage Iowans to reimagine, reengage, reconnect with arts and cultural experiences, a release said. The following received funds for marketing expenses in Pottawatomie County. Historic General Dodge House received $6,900. Historical Society of Pottawatomie County received $5,000. Pottawatomie Arts, Culture, and Entertainment received $17,800. Pottawatomie County Genealogical Society received $1,700. Preserve Council Bluffs received $2,100. These marketing grants and the Reimagine promotional campaign will help Iowa's arts and cultural sector welcome visitors back during the holiday season when many organizations rely on increased attendance and revenue to make ends meet, Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs Director Chris Kramer said in the release. This statewide investment will also help boost major exhibits, performances, and events now and into the new year. According to the release, the department is encouraging all Iowans to renew their love of performance, film, museums, and all of the arts and historical attractions that make our communities culturally vibrant, re-engage with Iowa arts, culture, film, history, and the humanities to support Iowa's growing creative workforce, reconnect with arts, history, film, and cultural experiences for personal well-being and to strengthen communities. In a typical year, Iowa's creative sector contributes $4.2 billion to the state's economy, employing more than 43,000 creative workers across more than 5,000 businesses statewide. In 2020, Iowa's nonprofit arts and culture sector lost millions in revenue and at least 4,500 arts, entertainment, and recreation jobs, stemming from event cancellations and closures due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Attempts to reach leaders with the Pottawatomie County organizations that received money weren't immediately successful on Monday. Visit iowaculture.gov for more information about the Reimagine campaign. Connections class encourages caregivers to practice self-care by Tim Johnson. Connections Area Agency on Aging will offer a pair of virtual lectures on the importance of self-care for caregivers. The program, Take Care to Give Care, will run from 9 a.m. to noon Friday. The event will feature two speakers, Brita Miller, and Julie L. Masters, PhD. Miller is an author, speaker, trainer, and playwright, according to a press release from the agency. She has spent her career serving clients in healthcare organizations, corporations, academic institutions, and nonprofit communities. Apart from her education, she came to her awareness of the value of self-care when she cared for her mother for nearly 6 years, including hospice care in her home. She is a graduate of the University of Detroit Mercy and has a variety of certifications and training programs. Through the power of story, audience interaction, and warm-hearted humor, Brita presents strategies that make a difference, the press release stated. Miller's presentation is Finding Your Light During Dark Days. Masters is a gerontologist and professor at University of Nebraska at Omaha. She holds the distinguished Terry Haney Chair for Gerontology. She teaches courses in gerontology and death and dying. In addition to teaching, Masters is involved in research related to end-of-life planning, along with research on COVID-19 and its effect on aging adults. Her presentation is Caregiving, A Time of Grace. Take Care to Give Care is free for family caregivers and $25 for professional caregivers. Continuing education hours are awarded by Iowa Western Community College, Iowa Board of Nursing Provider No. 6. To attend, please register at bit.ly/3HI1TBY or call Jan Schnack at 1-800-432-9209, extension 8116. Iowa spending up $3 billion in federal dollars, state auditor says, by Rod Boschart Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines. The state of Iowa spent about $12.3 billion in federal funds in fiscal 2020 that represented about a $3 billion increase, most of which was tied to the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, according to an audit issued Monday by State Auditor Rob Sand. Sand said about $2.3 billion of the 32.7% spike in federal aid the state received during the 2020 fiscal year came from the CARES Act, which changes in non-CARES and non-loan programs included an increase of about $518 million in funding for Medicaid expenditures. Expenditures directly related to the CARES program, according to the 96-page audit released Monday, included $1.4 billion in additional unemployment insurance, $605 million from the Coronavirus Relief Fund, $97 million for the Educational Stabilization Fund program, $56 million in CARES-related supplement school breakfast and lunch programs. Expenditures for programs not related to CARES included $4 billion for Medicaid, $1.4 billion in capitalization grants for clean water state revolving funds, $598.8 million for highway planning and construction, $491.6 million for unemployment insurance, $482.7 million for capitalization grants for drinking water state revolving funds, according to the report. While state officials administered about 600 federal programs during the year ended June 30, 2020, a total of five programs accounted for about 70% of the total federal expenditures not related to CARES funding. In his audit, the Democratic state auditor reported 9 internal control deficiencies and 3 instances of non-compliance at various state agencies within Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' administration, including $448,449 in unsupported salaries paid within the governor's office from the Coronavirus Relief Fund. According to Sand's report, the control deficiencies he cited address issues such as a lack of policies and procedures to ensure variances are identified and corrected, ways various reports are reviewed and approved, including all the proper information submitted to the federal government before the due date, and ensuring all required information is included. In addition, he said that there were 3 non-compliance findings addressing question costs of $113,813 paid to incarcerated individuals, $124,698 in payments to deceased individuals for unemployment insurance, and the $448,449 in unsupported salaries paid from the Coronavirus Relief Fund. He provided the state agencies with recommendations to address each of the findings. The governor had a budget shortfall. She had too many people on her personal staff and didn't have a big enough money to pay for all of them. So instead of addressing either the budget that she had or the number of staff she had, she decided to use CARES Act money instead, Sand said in an interview. We warned her back in October that it would be difficult for having her office's salaries qualify as a CARES Act usage and gave her specific directions how to make it most likely to qualify, Sand added. He noted that requests for documentation were not provided, and he expected federal overseers may request that some of the federal money not used for pandemic-related functions be returned. Alex Murphy, Reynolds Communication Director, issued a response Monday saying the U.S. Department of the Treasury confirmed that the use of coronavirus relief funds to reimburse the salaries and benefits of a governor's staff is an allowable expense. During this time, the governor's staff spent a vast majority of their time responding to the pandemic. In fact, many members of Governor Reynolds' staff worked 7 days a week out of the State Emergency Operations Center to provide direct support to Iowans. "This has always been our justification for the expense," said Murphy. "We are now working with Treasury to provide them documentation per their request." The governor's office did not respond to a request for comment on the state auditor's finding. A copy of the state auditor's report can be viewed at auditor.iowa.gov/reports/audit-reports. State college system adopts anti-discrimination policies over Ricketts' objection, by Chris Dunker, Lincoln Journal Star. Wayne. The Nebraska State College System on Thursday approved changes to two non-discrimination policies over the objections of Governor Pete Ricketts and a pair of religious groups. The changes passed on a 4-2 vote by the Board of Trustees. According to the state college system, the new policies ask employees to respect the chosen name and gender identity of other employees and provide greater clarity to the types of discrimination prohibited on campus. Both changes bring the system, which operates in campuses in Peru, Wayne, and Chadron, in line with other schools in both Nebraska and elsewhere, administrators said. While gender identity discrimination has been banned at campuses in Peru, Wayne, and Chadron since 2015, Ricketts, the Nebraska Family Alliance, and the Nebraska Catholic Conference criticized the changes as out of touch. Ricketts, in a November 10th letter urging the board to reject the update, painted the language as a concept being pushed at the national level by political activists, opposed by most Nebraskans. In particular, the governor and the religious group set a new system policy asking faculty and staff to respect the chosen name and gender identity of other employees whenever possible, would discourage employees and students from speaking freely. Kristen DeVell, the state's college system's general counsel, said there have been no issues on any of the state college system's campuses after an identical policy was passed for students in July. Speaking to the board, DeVell said the University of Nebraska, which put similar policies in place last year, also had not reported any problems. The board also expanded definitions of several protected classes Thursday. The changes arose out of the passage of LB 451 by the legislature earlier this year. The bill from Omaha Senator Terrell McKinney expanded Nebraska's laws prohibiting racial discrimination in employment to include hair texture and protective hairstyles. While the review was happening, the state college system reworked the policy banning discrimination on the basis of age, race, color, disability, gender identity, national origin, religion, sex, and sexual orientation, with definitions clarifying the intention of each. The original definition of gender identity discrimination, which the state college system pulled from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, included refusing to allow a person to use a restroom associated with the gender the person identifies with. The Nebraska Family Alliance and the Nebraska Catholic Conference criticized the language, saying it put women in danger on campus by allowing biological males who identify as female access to women's bathrooms. The state college system changed the language before Thursday's meeting, removing the reference to restrooms, but Ricketts suggested the policy would still increase the risk of sexual assault on campus. Even with the removal of the specific reference, acknowledging gender identity as a protected class still risks giving a guarantee of access, he said. Nebraska should be protecting our young people from a loss of privacy and safety, not inviting it. Several people who spoke during the public comment period of Thursday's meeting, including students at Wayne State College, also raised the idea the policy change would allow men to access women's bathrooms. But sexual assault advocates and law enforcement officials in cities and states with laws prohibiting gender identity discrimination have said there is no evidence to support claims that these policies lead to higher rates of sexual assault. Leaders in Wayne State's Student Senate, including President Blake Aspen, said the change was unnecessary and a solution in search of a problem. Abby Larson, a junior from Omaha, who is president of Pride, told the board the changes were a good step toward creating a more diverse and inclusive community at Wayne State. Voting against the policy changes were board chair Jess Zeiss of Omaha and trustee Bob Engels of Auburn. Matt Blomstead, who serves as an ex officio member of the board as Nebraska State Commissioner of Education, was absent from Thursday's meeting. Lincoln photographer lands role on General Hospital. Peter Salter, Lincoln Journal Star. His longtime National Geographic gig has carried Joel Satori and his cameras to all 7 continents and nearly 60 countries. He's been charged by elephants, bears, and bison, nearly lost part of his leg to a flesh-eating parasite, and had a brush with a deadly bat. But until last month, the Lincoln photographer had never visited the fictional town of Port Charles, New York, home to ABC's General Hospital, and he never had to deliver the scripted lines of a soap opera. I had them memorized, and then the lights came up, and I froze up. I'll tell you, it wasn't pretty. I'm going to get the Emmy for the most wooden performance. Satori will appear as himself on Tuesday's episode, a role he landed because the show's executive producer, Frank Valentini, is a fan of Satori's photo arc project. For more than 15 years, Satori has traveled the world attempting to photograph the estimated 20,000 species in captivity to showcase their beauty, value, and vulnerability. Over the years, Valentini had ordered a half dozen signed prints from Satori, though the photographer didn't know what his customer did for a living. Then the producer approached National Geographic with a proposal. Satori said, "What if the soap's fictional Jerome Gallery hosted an exhibition of real photo arc prints?" His bottom line is like mine, Satori said. We both care about wildlife. He wanted to do what he could to give the photo arc lift. Satori helped select the handful of prints that will appear on the gallery's walls, including the first public display of the project's 12,000th species. And the executive producer had more to his plan. What if Satori appeared on screen as the guest of honor? I said, "I'm not an actor," he said. "Oh, I know." Kathy Satori laughed when she heard about her husband's new role. It was such a funny idea he would be on a soap opera. The couple landed in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago and were impressed by the soap's warehouse-sized set and its production prowess. "I'm amazed by how hard these people work," Joel Satori said. The day they were there, the cast and crew tore through 125 pages of script. A big-budget, primetime TV show averages 6 or 7 pages a day, he said. Callie Satori was taken by the show's process and its pace. They've got it down so well. Every time they'd cut a scene, the hair and makeup people would run and make sure everyone was looking spiffy. Joel Satori saw his own signed photo arc prints decorating the executive producer's office wall. Kathy Satori saw familiar faces. She started watching General Hospital during its Luke and Laura era and still knows most of its characters. Luke's long gone, but Kathy Satori did take a picture of Laura's dressing room. When it's time for their shot, Kathy Satori was cast as an extra, though she's still not clear what her role was. "I'm not sure if I'm supposed to be Joel's wife. I was not really shot with him at all. I think I was an admirer at the gallery." But she did get to stand next to Ned Quartermain, one of the storyline's main characters. And her husband's performance wasn't as bad as he described it, she said. Joel does not memorize. He's a great off-the-cuff speaker, and so it was a challenge for him to say the exact words that were in his script, but he got through it. 5 takes later, when he was finished, the cast was gracious, Joel Satori said. "They were kind to me when I was flubbing the last 2 sentences. They applauded me when I got done, but no, I'm not an actor." Kathy Satori plans to watch the performance Tuesday, but her husband will miss it. The photo arc's remaining 8,000 species are calling, and he'll be headed to Costa Rica. "It's too bad," she said. "We would have had a good laugh together." Palmyra's second grade teacher dies in hunting accident. Kevin Cole, Omaha World Herald. A second grade teacher in the Palmyra School District died Saturday in a hunting accident in Pawnee County. Cade Ryman, who taught at Bennett Elementary, was 23. His family and the Palmyra District confirmed the death on social media. "It is with a heavy heart that I share some difficult news with all of you this evening," wrote Mike Hart, the school district superintendent. Cade Ryman, Bennett Elementary second grade teacher, died this afternoon. Hart said counselors were available at the elementary school on Sunday and Monday to assist with grief support. Ryman also coached high school football in Palmyra, and the counselors were available for team members, Hart said. A message on the Palmyra High School Boosters Facebook page said Ryman had just started to coach the junior high basketball team. "He will be deeply missed by all the athletes and coaches that had the joy of sharing a field or court with him," a booster wrote. The mother of a second grade boy in his class said in a post on the same Facebook page that her son could talk with Ryman about anything. "I will miss his big smile and wave while walking to his car and his updates on her son's school progress," she said. "He had a really big impact on his students." The Pawnee County Sheriff's Office is investigating this incident. Marine shooting brings scrutiny of air gun rules. Isabella Zaluska, The Gazette, Cedar Rapids. Iowa City. A loophole in the law that local authorities hope to close has prevented the Johnson County Attorney's Office from pressing serious charges against the man identified as shooting a projectile into the head of a passing Marine and badly injuring him. Iowa City police say that on October 17, Philip Olson, 69, was shooting at a squirrel in his yard with an air rifle but missed and instead hit Lance Corporal Gabe Hefner, 20, as he was driving by on Highway 6 near Sycamore Street. The Marine who crashed after being shot was severely injured. Last week, he was transferred from the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics to a clinic in Chicago. Olson faces fines for violating city code and Iowa Department of Natural Resources regulations after he voluntarily came forward to police shortly after the shooting. But authorities say they were blocked from charging him with a crime because air rifles are not considered dangerous firearms under Iowa law. Olson declined to comment when reached by the Gazette. Unlike firearms that use gunpowder, non-powder guns such as BB and pellet guns use air pressure, carbon dioxide pressure, or spring action to launch projectiles. There are no federal laws regulating the transfer, possession, or use of non-powder guns. More than half of states, including Iowa, do not regulate them either. The Marine's family and Democratic Johnson County attorney Janet Lyness say they favor legislation to classify these guns as firearms. At least two of Iowa's Democratic senators are in the early stages of discussing the incident ahead of the legislative season. It does seem like there is a loophole in the law because it's something that's not defined as a firearm or a dangerous weapon, which makes it hard to prosecute, Lyness said. People think of them as toys or BB guns, and they're not. They're lethal weapons, and they should be treated the same as firearms. But rather than enact more gun restrictions, the Iowa legislature has been heading in the opposite direction. Earlier this year, passing a constitutional carry measure making it optional to obtain a permit to buy or carry a handgun. And along party lines, where Democrats are outnumbered in both chambers, lawmakers gave final approval to putting a state constitutional amendment about gun rights before Iowa voters in 2022. In addition, the odd nature of the incident may not fuel much desire to address with a new law what could be seen as a tragic fluke. Senator Julian Garrett, Republican Indianola, said he read about the incident after being contacted by the Gazette. Garrett, vice chair of the Standing Judiciary Committee, said he wasn't sure if a legislative change was needed given the rare circumstances, but added that he hadn't had much time to think about it yet. My initial thought is this could happen anywhere. It happened in town, but it could have just as well been out in the country. I don't know if this is something that needs more legislation, Garrett said. If you're recklessly shooting toward any place where there might be a person, whether a highway or a building or a house or anything, you obviously gotta take care that you're not endangering somebody, he added. But no matter how careful you are, we all know things do happen. Garrett said some initial questions he has are whether something similar has happened in other states and how likely something like this is to happen again. Regulation in other states. The District of Columbia and 23 states regulate non-powder guns to some degree, according to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. The center, which promotes gun control and helps draft legislation, lists four main categories for regulations. According to the center, most states with such regulations have rules prohibiting transfers to children or by prohibiting or limiting where the guns can be possessed and used, such as schools. However, these restrictions typically don't apply when there is parental consent or adult supervision. Some states, including New Jersey and Rhode Island, define all non-powder guns as firearms. Some others, including Illinois and Michigan, treat high-power or high-caliber non-powder guns as firearms. In its definition of a firearm, Illinois does not include non-powder guns of .18 caliber or less, or non-powder guns with a muzzle velocity of less than 700 feet per second. Another group of states, including Connecticut, Delaware, and North Dakota, have non-powder guns in their definitions of dangerous weapons. Current limitations. An air gun doesn't fit the definition of a firearm in Iowa. If it did, Olson could have faced a charge of reckless use of a firearm, which is what Lyness would have wanted to charge him with. That is a felony if serious or bodily injury occurs. If you have an air rifle or other kind of weapon that are basically firearms, then let's classify them as firearms and treat them like that because the concern I have is that they are going to be misused, Lyness said. Niall Hefner, Gabe's father, said he would like to see air rifles and pellet guns classified as firearms because they can injure and kill like firearms. It's a sensible thing to do, Niall Hefner said. Sadly, my son is an example of what a .22 air rifle can do to a person, tragically changing the rest of his life. Perhaps that would persuade air rifle owners not to shoot within city limits so that another innocent person is not critically wounded or even killed. An air rifle or similar gun is not specifically defined as a dangerous weapon in Iowa law. A part of Iowa code that defines a dangerous weapon is any instrument or device of any sort whatsoever which is actually used in such a manner as to indicate that the defendant intends to inflict death or serious injury upon the other and which, when so used, is capable of inflicting death upon a human being, is a dangerous weapon. Lyness said there's a chance she could have proved with expert testimony that an air rifle is a dangerous weapon, but wouldn't have been able to prove Olson intended to inflict death or serious injury. Beginnings of discussion. Senator Joe Bolcom, Democrat, Iowa City, said he's spoken with Senator Kevin Kinney, Democrat, Oxford, about the incident. Both local Democratic senators are part of the state Senate Judiciary Committee. Kinney, a retired Johnson County lieutenant, said he wants to look at options before making any commitments about what he would support, but said it's something we do need to look at. It's something I want to talk with other people in law enforcement and my colleagues across the aisle to see what they would be willing to look at, said Kinney. Bolcom said he would be open to changes regulating air rifles, noting how these guns have become more powerful over the years. They're potentially lethal weapons at this point, and we need to begin to look at regulating them as lethal weapons, Bolcom said. They've gotten more powerful. These are not the guns that we used to have 20, 30 years ago when we were kids. But it would be up to the Republican-controlled legislation to decide if action needs to be taken, Bolcom said. Recovery continues. The Hefners moved to Missouri 8 years after Gabe was born in Iowa City. Gabe, the oldest of three children, was back in town visiting his grandparents when he was injured. On Wednesday morning, the same day as the 246th birthday of the U.S. Marine Corps, he was transported from UIHC to the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab in Chicago, a nationally ranked physical medicine and rehabilitation research hospital. The Iowa City Police Department escorted the ambulance. Gabe's mother, Cody, drove behind them. Along the route, people lined up to show their support for the Marine. In an update Thursday evening, Cody wrote that Gabe's first day at the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab included 3 hours of therapy and evaluations to see where he is at and to develop a plan for him. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, November 16, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Megan Newman from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners, and if you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Commentary. Rittenhouse and Arbery cases January 6th probe reveals stench of America's broken justice system. Will Bunch, the Philadelphia Inquirer. You've probably heard the old political maxim most popular in the crime-ridden 1970s that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged. In the 2020s, it turns out that a criminal justice reformer is now a white dude who suddenly finds himself in jail after taking part in an insurrection to keep Donald Trump in the White House. Right-wingers busted for taking part in the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol, raised in their movement's tough-on-crime agenda, are now shocked. Shocked to learn about conditions in the District of Columbia jail, where about 40 of the worst offenders are awaiting trial and complaining about everything from harsh treatment by guards to standing sewage and putrid food. Allies in the Trumpist movement claim this must be political retribution from big city liberals. Extremist GOP Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia compared them to prisoners of war. But the complaints are almost comical to DC-based activists who've been railing against these wretched conditions in their majority black city for years, only to have their pleas ignored. Even Washington's Attorney General had to concede that the publicity was only because of these new white inmates, that recent reports about squalid conditions in the district jails are unfortunately not new. The DC jail situation feels like a metaphor for a much bigger America phenomenon, as 2021, in which the nation is still trying to come to terms with the upheavals of the prior year, including the violent end to a profoundly criminal presidency and a racial reckoning that sent millions of citizens out into the streets, nears an end. After Trump and the George Floyd protests, Americans are apprehensively looking for justice and not liking what they are seeing so far. TV viewers this month have been riveted by the trials of the right-wing vigilante Kyle Rittenhouse and the three men who killed black jogger Ahmaud Arbery, and frequently appalled by what's on their screen. In the Georgia trial of the three white men who confronted Arbery with their unfounded belief he was a burglar and shot and killed him in the ensuing confrontation, the selection of a jury with 11 white members and just one African American in a 27% black county, and a defense lawyer's stunning comment that he didn't want black pastors as spectators, has made folks understandably question how far justice has really advanced in the American South. So far, the vibe is almost like the 1955 trial of two of the Mississippi white men who killed the black teen Emmett Till, acquitted by a laughing jury of 12 white men in just 67 minutes, in a trial where black spectators were largely segregated up in the balcony. But the biggest flashpoint so far has been the Kenosha judge, Bruce Schroeder, who is presiding over the homicide trial of Rittenhouse. He's the white Illinois teenager who crossed state lines with an AR-15-style rifle on a vigilante mission during August 2020 racial unrest after an ultimately unpunished cop shot Jacob Blake, who is black, in the back 7 times and ended up killing 2 men and wounding a third. TV viewers closely following live coverage of the trial on cable news are seeing how the Wisconsin bratwurst, if you will, of American justice is made as they watch the mercutial and often imperious Schroeder, a 37 veteran of the bench. His conduct has been weird or even appalling at times, from a cringe-invoking Asian food joke to asserting the courtroom to applaud on Veterans Day for a vet who was also a defense witness, but also seemingly skewed towards written defense of armed vigilantism. From preventing lawyers from calling the men gunned down by the teen as victims to blocking prosecutors for bringing up Rittenhouse's past, including an association with the violent Proud Boys, and also snapping, "Don't get brazen at me," at them, Schroeder's conduct has done nothing to reduce fears that this Kenosha trial would put a green stamp of approval on political violence just as it becomes a key tactic of the right. But ponder this. This is how Schroeder acts when the eyes of the entire nation are thrust upon him. Imagine how justice operates in his courtroom when nobody is looking. One fairly powerless woman, a 28-year-old Milwaukeean named Marika Brown, convicted of retail theft from a mall, found out that she had been sentenced in 2018 by Schroeder to 15 months followed by 2 years of supervised release, in which she was required to tell store managers about her criminal record in order to shop. The judge insisted embarrassment does have a valuable place in deterring criminality. But the Wisconsin Court of Appeals struck back and tossed that provision out, noting that public shaming isn't supposed to be part of the U.S. justice system. It's no wonder that a 2006 logjam in hearing cases in Kenosha County was tied to defendants desperate to have any other judge besides Schroeder hear their case, or that a black resident of Kenosha told the Washington Post that, "I think Kyle Rittenhouse is going to get off. They gave the case to the worst judge in town." There's just one more small reminder that the rule of law in this country, so often a key ingredient for those who believe in American exceptionalism, is not really at all. Arguably, the most exceptional thing about our legal system has been its steady decay since its ambition creation more than two centuries ago. You're surely familiar with the progressive critique of American justice, a draconian system that's harshly punitive compared to the rest of the developed world. Among similar nations, the United States has the highest incarceration rate, and it's not even close, and one of the few remaining death penalties, as well as extreme use of solitary confinement backed by a police force that is more militarized and more deadly. And almost every day brings new headlines about individual outrages, like a North Carolina man who spent 24 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit, thanks to a witness who entirely made up her testimony. But arguably an even deeper rot is the U.S. tendency to pat ourselves on the back for a revolutionary legal system when that revolution was in 1776 and most of the world has moved on to better, more progressive ideals. In a rare but revelatory 2008 piece, the New York Times legal writer Adam Liptak pointed out the U.S. Supreme Court is increasingly ignored as a role model by the rest of the world, with nations looking instead to European precedents in cases concerning equality, liberty, and prohibitions about cruel treatment. More narrowly, you can find a better example of the American preference for stale inertia over real reform than the fact that Schroeder, the worst judge in town, has been reconfirmed by voters again and again in his 37-year run. But I also think the reason that the precarious state of American justice is provoking so much anxiety right now is part of the hazy aftermath of last spring and summer's protests after the Minneapolis police murder of George Floyd. Despite their differences, the trials for Rittenhouse and Arbery's killers hinge on the same dangerous 2020s-inspired ideas. A conservative belief that citizens need to become vigilantes because a more progressive state, in which many political leaders endorsed, verbally if not so by their actions, the Black Lives Matter movement is a threat to white power. All four men in these closely watched trials were defending white supremacy, and their right to do that by any means necessary is what really is being judged this autumn. The problem is that Rittenhouse and three Georgia defendants are waging this battle on a playing field that is heavily tilted in their favor. It starts with the notion that white vigilantism and the American way of policing that rules our modern law and order regime are both rooted in the ideology of white supremacy dating back to the 19th century slave patrols. The 11-1 mostly white jury in the Arbery case reflects the reality that even a series of U.S. Supreme Court rulings and occasional stabs at legislation haven't been able to remove the specter of rank racial discrimination either from jury selection or the courtroom writ large. Instead, the American audience is getting a front row seat to a rap justice system that is wired in so many different ways, large and small, to favor those in society with wealth or with white privilege and to punish those like a Milwaukee shoplifter or the innocent man whose life was disposable to North Carolina's legal establishment, who are not. And in many ways, the ongoing January 6th investigation is where the rubber hits the road, since the assault on the Capitol, which ended with 5 dead, scores injured, many police officers, was both the extreme manifestation of the right's political violence fantasies and possibly a trial run for the next time that it could far be worse. The defendants push back on awful jail conditions that none of them would have dared protest for the majority black population is just one sign that these white accused criminals are expecting different treatment. What's so alarming is the very real possibility they will get what they want. In the sentencing of the mostly smaller fish who've pled guilty so far, the punishments for participating in an insurrection against the United States government have tended to be much more lenient than for a shoplifter in Kenosha or a black woman who mistakenly tried unsuccessfully to vote, also while on supervision. This weekend, folks on the left of the political dial did rejoice, and understandably so, over news that close Trump associate Steve Bannon, a key figure in what amounted to a coup attempt, has been indicted for contempt of Congress in refusing to testify before the House committee probing January 6th. But Bannon, indicted on other charges just last year only to be pardoned by Trump on the way out the door, and the other Trump associates declining to testify are playing a long game, hoping that the flaws inherent delays built into the justice system can stall any punishments until the GOP regains control on Capitol Hill and ends the probe. That leads to the most important question of all, which is whether President Joe Biden's deer-in-the-headlights Attorney General Merrick Garland will somehow summon the courage to do what his predecessors dating back to Gerald Ford's pardon of Nixon have not, hold an ex-president in Trump as well as his inner circle accountable for their crimes, starting with the insurrection they plotted in open view. The public anxiety over the trials of Rittenhouse and Arbery's killers isn't just over the immediate prospects for injustice, but also that the precedent of sanctioned political or racial violence will spread, pandemic-like, to the January 6th aftermath and then to the ultimate terror, that America is lurching toward a next presidential election in which one side will see violence as a legitimate tool for gaining power. And we are seeing nothing in America's rusted out and badly bent system of justice that suggests any serious willpower to stop them. Obituaries. Ronald Bluer, age 79, passed away on November 14, 2021. He was born June 6, 1942, to Merrill and Ruth Winston Luer in Council Bluffs, Iowa. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his sister, Barbara White. Ronald is survived by brother Larry Luer, nephews Stephen White and Randy Luer, niece Kay White Davidson. Memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. at Hoy Klonoski Funeral Home on Saturday, November 20th, 2021. Interment will be held at Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to Epworth Methodist Church, 2447 Avenue B, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51501. Chris Opel, age 61, passed away November 13, 2021. He was born June 28, 1960, to the late Eugene and Patsy Opel Sr. in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Chris graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School with the class of 1978. Chris is survived by his wife of 41 years, Paula Opel, children Andrew Opel, Adam Opel, Allison Codney, Alex Opel, siblings Eugene Opel Jr., Debbie Bly, Darla Bryant, Greg Opel, Patrick Opel, 9 grandchildren, nieces, nephews, cousins, and a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Hoy Klonoski Funeral Home on Thursday, November 18, 2021. Memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. at Hoy Klonoski Funeral Home on Thursday, November 18, 2021. The family will direct memorials. Neil Charles Polney, Neola, Iowa, passed away November 12, 2021 at the age of 85 years. He was born May 21, 1936, on his parents' farm near Portsmouth, Iowa. He attended a one-room schoolhouse near the home place and graduated from St. Mary's High School in Portsmouth. He loved farming from an early age and flourished in that profession and made a great number of friends throughout the Midwest. Although he and Marion moved to town, he never really retired. The last few years, he particularly enjoyed fixing up tractors for resale. We could always tell what model he was working on by the color of paint on his hands. Neil is preceded in death by his parents Ted and Rose Polley, siblings Kevin, Melvin, Terry, and Jeanette Polley, Bonnie Stoles, and Grace Collage, grandson Seth Polley, October 20th, 2021. Neil is survived by his wife of 63 years, Marion, Neola, Iowa, children Rose Polley, Council Bluffs, Randy Polley, Omaha, Linda Watts, Neola, Iowa, Rob Polley, Persia, Iowa, brother Lloyd Polley, sister Diane Polley Miller, 12 grandchildren, numerous great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, cousins, and many friends. Visitation, Tuesday 5 to 8 p.m. at St. Patrick's Church, Neola, Iowa. Mass of Christian burial, Wednesday 10:30 a.m., also at church. Interment, St. Patrick's Cemetery, followed by a luncheon at the church hall. Family will direct memorials. Keats, P.J. Tucker, If You Want Recognition, Then My Job Isn't a Job for You. Ira Winderman, South Florida Sun Centennial. He said it with a smile, something others might have expressed out of irritation, disillusionment. If you want recognition, P.J. Tucker offered, then my job isn't a job for you. He has learned to live without it. Actually, the veteran Miami Heat forward has learned to thrive in its absence. I don't care, he continued. I don't do highlights. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. Winning does. Contributing does. Complimenting does, even without the compliments. It has made Tucker the latest in a Heat lineage of those who prioritize success over statistics, a pantheon that has included the likes of Keith Askins, P.J. Brown, Bruce Bowen, Udonis Haslem, Shane Battier, Rodney Magruder, and others. He's just a winning player, Coach Erica Spoelstra said, with the Heat turning their attention to Monday night's game against the Oklahoma City Thunder, the final stop on a five-game trip. And that's probably the shame of it. To the average fan, unless we constantly educate people, no one will have any idea of how many things that he impacts. You'll notice it when he's on the other team's best player defensively, but it's the blockouts, it's the rotations, it's the protect side defense, and then offensively just getting people open constantly. And he does it in every way possible, whether he's screening, pick and roll basketball, or off ball screening. He's just elite in helping guys get open. That made Saturday's victory against the Utah Jazz somewhat of an exception when Tucker attempted 6 shots and scored 13 points, along with a team-high 11 rebounds. Point guard Kyle Lowry, in fact, noticed that when first shown the post-game box score, laughing that Tucker had the temerity to take that many shots. I mean, Tuck is one of the hardest-playing guys in the NBA. He should always make all-defensive team, Lowry said of the 6'5 Energizer. He's a guy who has no let-up, and no matter how tall he is, he plays at a bigger level. And his intensity of how he plays, how he handles situations, how he handles guarding people, how he handles his communication is awesome. He's a veteran's veteran, and he's a pro's pro. He's a man. You know what I mean? It's tough not to want to go in the battlefield with him. PJ is amazing, guard Duncan Robinson said. He doesn't care about literally anything but that scoreboard, and he'll do whatever it takes to win. I mean, he comes up to me and he says, my goal is to get you 15 threes. He's just selfless like that. You see the way he competes on defense and rebounds. He just wins all those in-between areas, and he brings a certain level of toughness that I just think sets the tone every single game. So just in terms of guys that I've played with, he's certainly one of my favorites, quickly becoming one of my favorites. I mean, it's hard not to love him as a teammate. Saturday proved to be a roller coaster, the Heat leading by 27 early, ahead 22 with 4:23 to play, and then up only 4 with 14.5 seconds to play before escaping 111 to 105. The constant was Tucker making plays for others. That's what winning is, he said. It's enjoying somebody else's success and knowing that if all my guys get off, if I can get Duncan wide open shots, if I can get Kyle open, if I can get Tyler open, it makes it easier for me. And then I get open shots, and then I can do the things that I do, so that's part of my job. In that respect, Tucker said the determination was similar during the 3-game losing streak the Heat carried into the game in Utah. Just try to figure out what you can do every night to help a team win. Even in losses, things you could have done and things you want to do better. It's building those things to try to get better, to win games now, to be able to play in the playoffs and having a chance at winning it. Lowry, a Tucker teammate in Toronto, said most teammates were aware of Tucker's uniqueness even before he signed in July as a free agent. I think the way he's played against everybody, I think a lot of guys have played against him, Lowry said, and you understand what he's going to give you every single night, so I think that's not really a surprise. Falcons, Bulldogs, Vikings represent Class A District 7. Peter Hugonen. St. Albert, Riverside, and AHSTW all had multiple players earn Class A District 7 honors for their performance this season. Riverside senior Austin Kamkowski was named the offensive MVP and earned a spot on their team first team offense. Kamkowski passed 1,493 yards and 15 touchdowns on 97 completions and rushed for 957 yards and 10 touchdowns on 97 carries. Senior Rhett Benley, sophomore Grad Jepson, and junior Nate Messerschmidt also earned first-team honors for the Bulldogs. AHSTW senior Denver Pauly, senior Raiden Grobe, and senior Jordan Ratzlaff, senior Blake Tuma, and junior Aiden Martin all made the first team for the Vikings. St. Albert junior Keaton Barnes and sophomore Brendan Monahan made the first team for the Falcons. A handful of players also made the Class A District 7 second team and honorable mention list. Athletes making the second team include Riverside senior Jace Rose, junior Aiden Salis, Junior Brody Zimmerman, Senior Nolan Moore, AHSTW Junior Kyle Stenberg, Junior Braden Lund, Junior Jacob Madsen, Senior Jace Peterson, Senior Quentin Martin, St. Albert Junior Brendan Monahan, Senior Dan McGarth, Junior Cale Hobbs, Junior David Helton, and Senior Nate Kay. AHSTW Junior Cole Schleffer and Senior Garrison Gettler, St. Albert Sophomore Brandon McCall and Sophomore Tony Bush, and Riverside Sophomore Kyle Regan and Junior J.J. Wilson all made the honorable mention list. Report. Kings coach Luke Walton on the hot seat could be fired if losing streak continues. Jason Anderson, the Sacramento Bee. A four-game losing streak has led to heightened speculation about Kings coach Luke Walton's future in Sacramento, with a new report suggesting his job could be in jeopardy if the team's struggles continue. The pressure on Walton is mounting as the Kings 5-8 prepare to face the Detroit Pistons 3-9 on Monday night at Little Caesars Arena. Citing sources, the Athletic's Sam Amick and Shams Charania reported Walton's job will likely be in peril soon if the current slide continues. The Kings went 5-4 to start the season with wins over Portland Trailblazers, Phoenix Suns, and Charlotte Hornets, but the mood in Sacramento has changed following four consecutive losses to the Indiana Pacers, Suns, San Antonio Spurs, and Oklahoma City Thunder. The Kings will conclude a four-game road trip against the Minnesota Timberwolves on Wednesday before coming home to play the Toronto Raptors, Utah Jazz, Philadelphia 76ers, and Blazers during a difficult four-game homestand. The Kings hired Walton, 41, to replace Dave Yoger in 2019. Walton, who is in the third year of a four-year contract, is 67-90 in his third season in Sacramento. He posted a 98-148 record in three seasons as head coach of the LA Lakers after spending 2 years as an assistant with the Golden State Warriors. Walton survived 2 9-game losing streaks last season, but owner Vivek Ranadive and general manager Monte McNair probably won't show the same kind of patience this season. The Kings have talked about avoiding long losing streaks and improving their historically bad defense, but they're already struggling to achieve those goals just 13 games into the season. Indians set a lawsuit with Guardians roller derby team by Tom Withers, AP sports writer. Cleveland. The Cleveland Indians have resolved a lawsuit filed by a local roller derby team over rights to the name Guardians, the final hurdle for the Major League Baseball team to continue its changeover. The sides jointly announced an amicable resolution on Tuesday saying both organizations will continue to use Guardians. No other terms of the agreement were disclosed. The legal scuffle had delayed the Indians' transition to Guardians, which will soon become official. The American League franchise has been known as the Indians since 1915. The club next season will be called the Guardians, a name chosen following a year-long process that sprang from a national reckoning over racist names and symbols. Last month, the Cleveland Guardians roller derby team, which was formed in 2013, filed its lawsuit alleging the switch from Indians to Guardians infringed on its trademark and employed deceptive trade practices violating a state law. A major league club cannot simply take a smaller team's name and use it for itself, the lawsuit said. There cannot be two Cleveland Guardian teams in Cleveland, and to be blunt, plaintiff was here first. The Indians were hoping to have Guardians merchandise available to fans this month with the holidays approaching. This month, the baseball team began removing signage in and around Progressive Field. U.S. journalist jailed for months in Myanmar lands in New York by Ted Schaffery and Bobby Kana Clavin. New York AP. American journalist Danny Fenster, who was freed after nearly 6 months in jail in military-ruled Myanmar, arrived Tuesday in the United States for an emotional reunion with his family. Fenster, who was sentenced last week to 11 years of hard labor, was handed over Monday to former U.S. diplomat Bill Richardson, who helped negotiate their release. He is one of more than 100 journalists, media officials, or publishers who have been detained since the military ousted the elected government of Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi in February. "It's been a long time coming, a moment I had been imagining so intensely for so long," a bearded and shaggy-haired Fenster said after landing in New York. "Surpasses everything I had imagined." As he exited a car outside an airport motel, Fenster's mother rushed over to hug him, as did his father and brother. Late Monday, as Fenster transited through Qatar, he told reporters that he was physically okay and had not been starved or beaten while in custody. While jailed, he had told his lawyer that he believed he had COVID-19, though prison authorities denied that. Fenster, the managing editor of an online magazine, Frontier Myanmar, was convicted Friday of spreading false or inflammatory information, contacting illegal organizations, and violating visa regulations. Days before his conviction, he learned he had been charged with additional violations that put him at risk of a life sentence. It feels great to get Danny back home. It's worth the effort, worth everything we did, said Richardson, a former governor of New Mexico and past ambassador to the United Nations who helped negotiate the release through his foundation. Fenster's mother, Rose, described the ordeal as a nightmare, and the family expressed relief that it was over. It feels great. He's safe. That's all we want, his father Buddy said. Fenster, in a knit hat that said he said was a gift from another prisoner, joked that the first thing he would do is get a shave and a haircut. Fenster has been in detention since he was arrested at Yangon International Airport on May 24th. The exact allegations against him were never clear, but much of the prosecution's case appeared to hinge on proving that he was employed by another online news site that was ordered closed this year during the crackdown on the media that followed the military takeover. Fenster used to work for the site but left that job last year. A native of the Detroit area, Fenster has a master's degree in creative writing from Wayne State University and worked for a newspaper in Louisiana before moving to Southeast Asia, according to Deadline Detroit, a news website to which he occasionally contributed. His brother Brian has said he was particularly interested in the plight of people from the Muslim Rohingya minority, hundreds of thousands of whom fled Myanmar during a brutal counterinsurgency campaign by the army in 2017. The generals in Myanmar were convinced that it wasn't worth it to hang on to Danny, U.S. Rep. Andy Levin of Michigan, who represents the Fenster family in Congress, told Detroit radio station WWJ. If they kept him and anything really happened to him, we would never forget it. We would never forgive them. Richardson is known for traveling to nations with which Washington has poor, if any, relations, such as North Korea, to obtain the freedom of detained Americans. He has a long history of involvement with Myanmar, starting in 1994, when as a member of Congress, he met Suu Kyi at her home, where she had been under house arrest ordered by a previous military government. Wall Street opening slightly higher, Home Depot up 4%, by Joe McDonald, AP Business Writer. Stocks are opening slightly higher on Wall Street Tuesday, led by gains in the consumer discretionary sector. Home Depot is leading the S&P 500 gainers after the hardware chain sales continued to surge last quarter in a hot housing market. New data also showed Americans sharply boosted their spending last month, pushing up retail sales and giving the economy a lift. The S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average are up 0.3% in early trading, and the NASDAQ Composite rose 0.2%. Global stock markets are mixed after President Joe Biden and China's Xi Jinping held a summit meeting by video link. This is a breaking news update. Global stocks were mixed Tuesday after President Joe Biden and China's Xi Jinping held a summit meeting by video link. Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Frankfurt advanced while Shanghai declined. London and Wall Street futures were little changed. Biden and Xi announced no agreements after their meeting but said their governments need to tread carefully amid tension over trade, Taiwan, and other irritants. Biden told Xi their goal should be to ensure competition does not veer into conflict. Xi said he was ready to build consensus, and so the two sides need to improve communication. In early trading, the FTSE 100 in London lost less than 0.1% to 7,350.82, while Frankfurt's DAX advanced 0.2% in 16,174.84. The CAC 40 in Paris added 0.3% to 7,149.45. The future of Wall Street's benchmark S&P 500 index was unchanged, and that for the Dow Jones Industrial Average was off 0.1%. On Monday, the S&P 500 and the Dow lost less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ Composite also declined less than 0.1%. In Asia, the Shanghai Composite Index fell 0.3% to 3,521.79, while Tokyo's Nikkei 225 added 0.1% to 29,808.12, less than 0.1% to 29,783.18. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong was up 1.3% at 25,713.78. The Kopsi in Seoul lost less than 0.1% to 2997.21, and Sydney's S&P ASX 200 shed 0.7% to 7420.40. India's Sensex sank 0.6% to 60,378.89. New Zealand declined while Southeast Asian markets rose. Also, Tuesday, the Commerce Department was due to report U.S. retail sales. U.S. investors are shifting focus from the latest corporate profits to economic issues that will determine growth into 2022. That includes supply chain problems and rising inflation. Investors will be watching for any signs inflation is crimping business operations or consumer spending. Businesses have raised prices to pass along higher costs of materials. Consumers have taken that in stride, but analysts worry they might start to pull back on spending. Investors are also waiting to see whether Biden decides to nominate Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell for a new term to lead the U.S. central bank. Chinese data reported Monday showed October retail sales growth weakened compared with the previous month, weakened by an anti-coronavirus restrictions and consumer unease over a wave of outbreaks. In energy markets, benchmark U.S. crude rose 55 cents to $81.43 per barrel in electronic trading on the New York Mercantile Exchange. The contrast advanced 9 cents Monday to $80.88. Brent crude, used as the price basis for international oils, added 73 cents to $82.77 per barrel in London. It sank 12 cents the previous session to $82.05 per barrel. The dollar rose to 114.18 yen from Monday's 114.09 yen. The euro declined from 1.1370 US dollars from 1.1386 US dollars. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, November 16th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Megan Newman from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.